be doing a recorded show. Please enjoy.
You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and you just heard jazz with fava beans and a nice Chianti with the incomparable DJ Lamb Chop. Today, I'm very happy to be re-airing an episode from the Living Writers Archives. Today, we have Isha Sabatini Sloan and Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. It's just been reprinted this year by Grey Wolf Press in February of 2024. Isha will be reading and in conversation tomorrow at Literati, 6:30 p.m., Literati Bookstore. So you could head there to hear and see Isha Sabatini Sloan in person to celebrate the reprinting of her excellent, excellent book of essays, Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoy today's conversation with Isha Sabatini Sloan from the Living Writers Archives. Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Isha Sabatini Sloan here in the studio with me. Isha, welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming down on a beautiful day here in Ann Arbor. It's so great to see you. Today we've got your second book on the table with us, Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, out with 1913 Press. And we've got Gina Brandolino, engineering, and we've got Stephanie Carpenter Douglas here, engineering as well. So the gang's all here.
Yay.
And glad that you're tuning in and listening to join us today, too. So glad you're here. We'll start with the convention of the show, a short bio, and we'll fill in the pieces. Isha Sabatini Sloan was born and raised in Los Angeles. She has an MA in cultural studies and studio art from the Gallatin School of Individualized Study at NYU, and an MFA in Creative Nonfiction from the University of Arizona. Her essay collection, The Fluency of Light, Coming of Age in a Theater of Black and White, was published by the University of Iowa Press in 2013. Her most recent essay collection, The Book of the Day, Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, is available now from 1913 Press. Isha is also the visiting professor of creative nonfiction for the Helen Zell Writers Program here at the University of Michigan. And I'm lucky enough to know you. So glad to see you here today, Isha.
Oh, the luck is all mine.
So let's talk about Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. This book, wonderful collection of essays. How did this collection, how long has it been in the works, Isha? Because I know from looking at the different acknowledgments, too, these essays have been placed out in the world. So what's the story of the collection itself of the essays?
Well, to a large degree, I think it felt like it was rooted in this one essay that I wrote in 2013, which is the first essay of the book, A Clear Presence. I think that was accomplishing something that I had been curious about in that moment in my life, where I was doing a lot of not only meditating but going to meditation classes, and I was in like a meditation sangha, and one of the things that we did that was really powerful to me was, you know, a lot of Buddhism requires that you sort of, or suggests that you contemplate your mortality and the mortality of others. And I think we did this one meditation on a series of people in our lives, just imagining them sick, far away, and deceased. And it was surprisingly, we did this in a room full of people, and people I didn't know very well in this class.
And you said it, you shared it out loud? It wasn't something that you
thought
of?
Internal. It was internal? Okay. Yeah, it was a guided meditation.
I see.
And there was something so powerful about that experience, and I wanted to write essays that felt like they were encountering death in a similar kind of way, where it was sitting with mortality and with the fact of death, but also kind of reaching where we all in this room got together, the other side, which was surprisingly, it was kind of a relief to go there. We were all a little bit, and we did share, I think, at the end how it felt. And so there was just a seed in that experience that I wanted to explore. And I had these ideas for essays that I wanted to write.
That came to you during the meditation or sometime after because something had opened from that, the seed of that experience.
Exactly. Something had opened from that. And it was just on my mind. I also had the idea of spending time, and a lot of writers have done this, and I don't know that I followed through on this exactly, but going to locations that where something catastrophic had happened and just sort of sitting there. So that was sort of the foundation of the book in a lot of ways. And I think A Clear Presence, that first essay, laid the groundwork for what I imagined the other essays might do. And of course, in the way that so many book ideas kind of open out and close and then open out again, there were a lot of other things that I thought I might accomplish as well, that I think are other future projects that I hope to get to. But that was sort of the basis of it.
And that was in 2013. And so you already...
Did
the meditation and sort of...
It must have been before that, because that's when I moved back to LA. So it was in the years... It was probably between 2009 and 2013 that I had been doing a lot of that work.
And was that in Arizona?
Yeah.
When you were getting your MFA at Arizona?
I finished my MFA in 2008, but I did stay on, and I had a wonderful... I still have a wonderful community of people there. And one of the ways that we were all kind of deepening our relationships to that place and to each other was through, we just, one year, everyone broke up from their partners and started going to this meditation circle. That was sort of the thing that happened. And we remained in creative community with each other also. And so that was really important, because I think ending your MFA can be a little bit traumatic. So, we had this really special experience of sort of healing and growing and biking around and eating pizza in Tucson together, because Tucson's a really cheap place to live. So
is it still?
That's the thing. That's, too.
That sounds great.
I don't know if it's, I think it's probably getting more expensive,
yeah.
But it's still a lot. It's, I think it's twice as expensive to live here.
I believe it.
Yeah.
The side tips on living writers, people, real estate across the nation.
Yeah.
I love that you said creative community, though. And are those folks that you're still in contact with now, even though there's some perhaps distance involved? And,
oh, yeah.
And how is that working? Because then you returned to LA and then you had a return to this area, because your family has roots in Detroit, and
yeah.
You've visited sort of, yeah, take it away, Isha.
Well, I don't know.
Because you return to this area.
Yeah.
Detroit, now Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And Ypsilanti is,
yeah,
home.
Well, I felt a really naive urge to go back to Los Angeles. I think I thought I had reached a certain level of maturity because I was doing so much yoga and meditating, and I was waitressing and teaching, and I just felt really, and I had finished my first book. I had passed through some kind of threshold, and I felt like I can tackle anything. I'm going to go back to my childhood home.
Bring it on, LA. Yeah.
And I'm just going to do some writing there. And I think we all know that moving back into your childhood home brings with it complications. But yeah, I just wanted to spend some time with my mom, because my dad was teaching in Savannah, Georgia at the time, and I just wanted to hang out and keep her company and get some writing done. And the setting for A Clear Presence sort of was inspired in some part by the event of this Christopher Dorner rampage, which happened when I happened to be back in L.A. So in some ways, the writing was prompted by events. But also, yeah, it was a year that began several years that I'm hoping have ended of moving constantly. I think I moved, I'm not sure how many times in that span of time, but I've moved, I think, 15 times since college. So it was just a period of transition. I ended up moving back to Tucson for a time. And then my partner and I thought we were going to move to Michigan, and then we moved back to Tucson again, and then finally moving again back to Michigan, where my parents ultimately ended up, which is where they had a home that they got in, I think, 1969 or so. They're back in that historic house with lots of history and maybe one fewer ghost than when they first moved in.
One fewer. Oh, that's great. Talking about A Clear Presence, the lead essay in your collection, Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, Isha, when you returned to L.A., it also gave you the chance to go to the location of where Rodney King was severely beaten. And you were talking about how, with, I think, connecting it to the Buddhist practice of going to a place, and that becomes part of A Clear Presence as well.
Well, I didn't go to that specific intersection.
I see.
But I do follow him there, which might be what you're remembering, because he, for this VH1 reality TV show.
That is it. Thank
yeah.
You.
He goes with Dr. Drew to that location, and it's a really important sort of psychological and spiritual moment of healing for him.
Although reading the essay, I thought, how painful and sort of right. terrible for this reality TV show to put him through that.
Yeah.
But then, well, he says that actually was something he needed.
Yeah. 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 As meditating on the corpse of someone you love seems like it would be traumatic, but might actually bring about a certain kind of relief that you wouldn't ever have expected.
It's relief, Isha?
I think that's the word that comes to mind. Because it's a thing that you avoid thinking about. And I think there's a lot of effort put on a daily basis and not imagining something horrible and just letting it happen. I think it just allows for the reality of death to sort of, you relieve the effort of pushing it away. I don't know that it feels good. It just feels like some of that anxiety and effort of keeping it at arm's length is not happening.
And is it something that you feel like doesn't return then? Is it sort of a release valve? You've shown your mind or your being a way of experiencing, so you don't rebuild up or you don't keep expending that effort? Or what's your experience been?
Well, I think there's an app. I don't have it personally, that some friends have told me about, that just it gives you a reminder every, I don't know, as frequently as you want, that you're going to die. And it's
Whoa.
Rooted in the same idea that you can't forget. It's something you have to keep reminding yourself of. And I think a lot of the philosophies that I encountered during that time were an effort to sort of weave into your daily life the practice of accepting and facing mm-hmm. the fact of death, not necessarily once and for all, but just mm-hmm. sort of periodically. And there's a weird way in which it can create a sense of peace, because I don't know where it is that we think we are living when we kind of build up the idea, this fiction, that we're never going to die, but it's not real.
And do you think it connects with the loss as well, or do you think it's more separate from that, like death, the thing itself, or as opposed to the loss experienced after a death?
I don't know. I think that's That's a good question. I think the loss is in there. And of course, it's different to do for yourself than it is for other people. Yeah, it's just maybe tapping in a little bit to that grief without necessarily having to. There's just not living in the unreality of imagining that you can, with the force of your will, keep it from happening. I think there's just something about that fiction that's kind of bad for us.
Isha, I'm so glad you're here today. I can almost hear my heart beating through. It's really enjoying this conversation. And also now I realize why they don't probably put living writers on a Friday, right? Things you didn't expect to talk about today, right, Isha, necessarily? But today on Living Writers, Isha Sabatini Sloan is here, dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. The book of essays on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Gina and Steph behind the glass, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on the program, Isha Sabatini Sloan is here, dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, the book that we're talking about today. And so glad you're joining us. Isha, thanks for picking the songs for today's program.
It was my pleasure.
Could you tell us a little bit about what we just heard, the opening notes of?
Yeah, there's an essay called Ocean Park Number 6 that I wrote in part to try to kind of take a creative and emotional journey with a close friend of my mother's and close friend of mine. And through the sort of artistic points of artistic kind of catharsis that she experienced that we kind of shared, the painter Richard Diebenkorn in particular, the author Michael Ondaatje, and it was in some ways almost like a detective story. I was trying to sort of circle around something. In having conversations.
The loss of her son.
The loss of her son. Yeah, which in some ways that witnessing her loss for me, just biographically, was interwoven with the fact that she was also sort of the, in many ways, benefactor of my artistic coming of age to a large degree. I mean, I had a lot of influences, but she really provided me with a lot of important artistic sort of points of reference growing up. And so I was thinking about the relationship that had with just the fact that she's a person who experienced an extraordinary loss. And in order to stay in that space, I noticed that I started listening to a certain soundtrack. And one of those songs or one of those bands was Grizzly Bear. And I had some really bizarre experiences where I went to a coffee shop and I was reading about color. I think I was looking in Remarks on Color by Wittgenstein, and I looked up and there was Diebenkorn, and I was thinking about Richard Diebenkorn in particular, and I looked up and there was a record album with one of his Spades paintings, Diebenkorn's, and I looked to see what album it was, and it was Grizzly Bear, and I don't remember. I think that that's one of the reasons I started listening to them. But it was a really strange moment that I think in some ways kind of drove the essay.
And you write about that moment in the essay too. Yeah. It's a present part of...
Let me see if I can find it. I mean, I think I just explained it, but if I can find it, I can tell you. It probably will just be...
Well, and you... It's throughout Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, you have many painters and writers, artists. They're interwoven throughout the essays. It seems like almost... I mean, maybe not 100%, because I wasn't going through trying to see, but it seems like there's almost a painter in every one or so, and writers too. And I love that interconnectedness and some of the surprises that come from that as well.
Yeah, and that's always been a cornerstone for me in my writing. I think it's hard for me to write about a subject without having kind of the distorted lens of an artist or an art piece to look at it through. So
why?
I think I just need a third thing. I have myself and I have the thing, but there's something about it. It's almost like I'm imagining, I've been thinking a lot about like diagrams and drawings of you know, sort of like a prism or something like that. But there's something I feel like I have to ping off of before I can get to the thing. In some ways, maybe it has to do with a sort of like disavowal of objectivity. Like I need there to be an occasion. I need there to be a almost like imprecision somehow, or a, something to that distorts. Like when I'm imagining this creative act, I'm imagining a distortion, like a looking through a prism. And so for the Rodney King essay, I was looking through the work of David Hockney, and for the for this essay, Ocean Park Number 6, I'm looking at Juliet through the work of Richard Diebenkorn, which is one of her favorite painters, and through it she experienced her son's death. And most of the other pieces, there's that sort of third, fourth, or fifth sort of element to kind of contextualize. Because I think there's a degree to which I really resist the idea of writing with any kind of authority. I've never been attracted to that kind of writing. And so I think something that kind of pushes me to encounter a subject with this added task of thinking through the art or through the music, so that it's not pretending to be the definitive essay on a certain subject. I think that I'm just thinking of that now. It's not something that I've thought about before, but I feel like that's potentially part of, I don't trust that voice coming from myself, and I don't particularly like it coming from other people either. I mean, it might depend on the person.
Well, and that connects to something that you've, like vulnerability of the writer, like how that would be important as an element to be able to take that risk yourself as the writer, to maybe the not knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. So many of the authors I was reading sort of over the course of my MFA that really spoke to me, kind of destabilized themselves as like a kind of ritual offering for the reader, you know, not ritual offering. That might be a little bit too grandiose, but there's like a kind of, almost, I think similar refusal to be, the be all end all, the voice of logic or just, I'm thinking about the vulnerability of Ulibis and Maggie Nelson and Claudia Rankine, you know, talking about having cancer and in her first book.
Don't Let Me Be Lonely.
Don't Let Me Be Lonely. And just the ways in which narrators use their fragility, and that's a tricky term right now, but vulnerability too. I'm trying to think. There was another word that came to mind, but their fallibility as almost it's like a requirement of the frame that they're talking through. And because I think so many of us need that in order to trust someone. Yeah.
And that's sort of building the trust with your reader or build it with who you are writing out to.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one hopes. Who one, knows?
Right. Right. 100%. No. Just... Well, Isha, let's. Do you mind? Could we hear from a clear presence?
Sure.
That what we started, the essay that begins the book, and that you mentioned lays the groundwork for almost like the how each of these the essays to come. I don't know, came into being. That sounds a little bit too much as well, but laying the groundwork for the feeling of what's necessary, like to have that opening or that distortion.
Yeah, yeah. I'll read just from the very beginning, A Clear Presence. When I was in junior high school, my mother and I heard the sound of helicopters while house-sitting for friends in the Hancock Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. We had just come in from using the swimming pool when someone on a megaphone instructed us to come outside with our hands up. When we did, policemen were facing the house with guns pointing toward the door. Neighbors were standing on their porches in alarm, and a helicopter was hovering overhead. Our dog ran outside, and we squealed with terror that they shouldn't shoot her. It turned out that we'd accidentally triggered the security system's distress signal, and it took a while for them to determine that we were not being taken hostage. But the incident was, in some ways, an elaborate confirmation of a feeling that I held already about the house and the city in general, that even though we had permission to be there, we had somehow managed to trespass. When he was a young man, the Olympic diver Sammy Lee was allowed to use the public pool only on a certain day in the week reserved for people of color. After that day, the pool was drained and refilled for the comfort of the white patrons. My father remembers hearing, during an interview with Lee, that the diver returned years later after his win and confronted the people who maintained the pool to ask why they felt the need to drain it, as if his Korean background and the black skin of his friend had somehow infected the water. They told him that, to the contrary, they always considered the order ludicrous. Rather than draining the pool as they'd been told, they would lock the doors for a couple of hours and add a little extra chlorine to satiate the people in charge. But the fact of Lee's exclusion, the lie of his body being a contaminant, had already influenced his understanding of the world. In a recurring dream, I'm swimming in somebody else's pool. The city is always Los Angeles. The grounds are always well maintained. There is often a flourishing garden filled with climbing vines of jasmine, bougainvillea, and bird of paradise. The house to which the pool belongs is empty. I might get out of the water to wander around, always with the sense that while I've been invited, I'm not supposed to be there. In his book on lucid dreaming, B. Allen Wallace writes that the dreamer can prepare to awaken in his sleep by following the Buddhist practice of shamatha before bedtime. Quote, the mind's distractions are stilled so that one's attention can eventually rest comfortably and effortlessly on a chosen object for hours on end, end quote. In the attempt to cultivate this ability, I stare at a coffee cup on the table in front of me. I feel flickers of that sensation I used to know well as a child, when I could look at a truck parked on the street outside of our apartment and feel that the world radiated out in all directions, that infinity existed inside of each scene and every second, like the sound of wind or falling water. Once at a museum in London, I saw a set of portraits by the painter David Hockney. Everyone portrayed in that particular series worked as a docent in a museum. Hockney sometimes uses a roller in his painting so that the shape and shadow that realistically depict a nose or chin float inside a stilled space that has been divorced from the rippling pulse of passing time. If, as the curators have demonstrated, you look at the Polaroid image that was used as a reference for the portrait that Hockney would later create, you can see the way that he brings the friends he paints into a new realm by stripping away the subtlest of layers, creating a dimension that is at once matte and luminous, breathing and flat. And though I've only had a handful of lucid dreams myself, I wonder if Hockney's realm isn't just the quiet landscape of a lucid dream, a distillation and capture of that intangible state of being that we have talked to death, can't possibly bear utter again, but still seem desperate to enter. Through his brush, the present moment becomes a kind of shoebox diorama inside which the viewer can wander, take refuge, and maybe a nap.
Thank you, Isha.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for choosing that part to read too today.
It felt right.
Wonderful. Okay, we'll take a short break and then we'll come back. We'll talk more. And I love that you ended on, it was so surprising to me when I read it the first time, or perhaps a short nap. It was such a surprise somehow. Anyway, so glad you're here. Today, Isha Sabatini Sloan, the book Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on the program, Isha Sabatini Sloan is here, Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, out with 1913 Press. Isha, could you tell us a little bit about what we just heard, the song?
Yeah, so when I was writing my first book, one night I was listening to KCRW, the program in LA, and it was the drive, the donation drive. And I thought, you know, I should give. And so
we'll have to have you back for fundraiser. Do you mind?
I don't know about that. But, so I donated and I got in the mail as a prize. I got this album, Let England Shake by PJ Harvey, and I could not stop listening to it. And it ended up showing up in one of the essays that I wrote, I think it was called Silencing Cassandra, which she did these interviews for I think all of the songs with veterans about their experience of war, and then she used a lot of the language from those interviews in the songs, but I just found them incredibly emotional and cathartic to listen to. And she talks about I don't know if this is just an interpretation or if it's something that she said. I'll have to go back to that essay, but I do think she talks about sort of like channeling that pain. But also, I was reading, I think, the Glass essay.
By Ann Carson?
Yeah, by Ann Carson. And she was talking about that act that someone, a woman would perform. I think it's Chose, C-H-O-E-S or something like that. I shouldn't be talking without it in front of me, but the act of sort of channeling the grief of a community. And I felt very strongly that that's what P.G. Harvey sort of felt herself to be doing through this album. And so that's why that song in particular is just really the quality of her voice is very kind of ragged and yeah, moan like. So I just, my poor neighbor, 3 o'clock in the morning, I would just have played it probably 15, 20 times as I was just trying to get in the groove. Cause I wrote a lot of my first book in the middle of the night, but she never complained. So I think it's okay. But yeah.
And do you think that was something different for you then, writing in the middle of the night when you were writing that first book?
Yeah, I've tried since, and it's no longer as accessible as a time of day for me to write in. But I don't know that. I think for a while, I think I was just, I don't know what it was about my body that I could do that, because I was working two jobs, and I would just come home and write till 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I don't know why I didn't need sleep.
Could you? Because I was going to say, could you turn your mind off then? Because and
probably
be able to sleep.
I think
maybe
I was.
That's why you have the lucid dreams.
Well, I've always struggled with lucid dreaming. My friends, especially in Tucson, were amazing at it. They would have these crazy lucid dreams and talk about them all the time. And I feel like I was kind of the odd man out. I've had some since. And I was just actually teaching at the bio station for this GLACE program. And we talked a lot about dreams, and a lot of people talked about whether or not they could lucid dream.
And it makes it like its presence known, in a clear presence to lead off this collection.
Right. Yeah.
In the part that we got to hear before the break, Isha, there's so many, I feel like, thanks for choosing that to read, because I think folks will have a sense of what's to come, because what you're also doing and how, in a book like Dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit, I believe a reader gets a chance to kind of know something about the maker of the book, the writer, in a way, because these are personal essays that you don't, or that you really shouldn't assume if you're reading fiction or poems or so. And we get to see how you were even talking about the prism or the distortion and things bouncing from each other. We heard through the reading of that section, the different voices, the Buddhism, the Hockney introduced another, and were moved to invited into different spaces, like to step in to a shoebox diorama or, but we start with a scene that's from your own life, but earlier in time, junior high, with a family member and your mother in this case, but your father also surfaces because he's an important voice throughout the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much, so many, threads.
Yeah. It's so funny as you're talking, I know that we both are fans of Jane Miller's writing, and I took a class with her when I first started at U of A, and she was writing Midnights at the time. And I just, for me, it felt so important. And she was sort of making a concession towards prose poetry, which she didn't ever really feel like she would normally write. But it was, I feel like, something about her approach to talking about the past through the lens of the present really, I think, informed something for me about how I wanted to write nonfiction. And so even talking, about the past, but having the present be sort of a necessary point in that prism of distortion or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Well, because in this same, no, sorry, I jumped to the Ocean Park essay then, thinking about you at the cafe. But I think in each of the essays, you're moving through time, and it almost feels like there is a present, like, obviously the writer, your voice is the mind at work, is present in the present moment. So that, I guess, maybe would just count for that element of it. But I feel like there is always these moments of looking back to the previous the personal narratives or stories from the family, or one of your dad's many stories, because it sounds like he was a model as a storyteller as well as an artist, like someone who has made, you know, he's a photographer.
Yeah. And he also, I just recently started listening to these. He wrote essays for Weekend Edition. And I just got a hold of a couple of them because they were really generous and just sent them right over. And I didn't realize the extent to which even... Because I always knew that his influence as a photographer and as a journalist, and he's interviewed people a lot over the course of his career, but I didn't realize the extent to which essay writing itself was something that he also kind of modeled. So I don't know that I can take credit for anything. Really, I'm just a copycat. But yeah,
no. But let's talk a little bit more about well, you're not a copycat. I'll say that right away.
It's okay to be a cop. I don't know.
Talking about, let's talk a little bit about Detroit,
sure.
If you don't mind, because your dad and your mom, both from Detroit,
yeah.
And both, like we said at the beginning, towards the beginning of the program today, they've returned because more family is like still obviously still Detroit is home, and they are living in the 1969 house, And you have a relationship with the city from returning as a kid and knowing your family this way, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now it's more of, well, is it a home base? Because there is an essay, several essays where Detroit features in it prominently. And one of the essays, you actually write about... that you don't really say bad things about Detroit, like say good things. There was some resistance and struggle with even the making and then the publishing of this particular essay.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that as well? Do you mind like this? I don't know. Why was this the time?
Yeah. That's it. I don't know really. I think, The essay is about a ride along that I took with my cousin, who was a lieutenant, and she just had been offering for me to go along with her, and I had always been terrified, but for some reason one summer I thought, okay, I'll do it.
And how old would you have been then, Nisha? Do you recall?
I was in my 20s. I was Yeah, I think after maybe, it was probably 2012 or so. Yeah, I think it was 2012. It's probably in there.
Well, in the essay, I think your parents weren't thrilled that you were doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Or your
my
dad
parents,
especially.
Yeah, are never thrilled at that kind of thing. But there is that sort of adage that, you know, people from Detroit don't say bad things about Detroit. And so I had a lot of difficulty with this essay that was kind of revealing a lot of horrible stories that my cousin had encountered over the course of her career. And I don't know. There's a part of me that doesn't know what the occasion was or is for sharing those kinds of stories, but I don't know how productive it is not to talk about what needs fixing.
For example, the police car itself,
mm-hmm.
Your cousin would be trying to, I don't know if it was roll up the window or like a side panel would just come off
right
before you were driving out and you buckled up, but she said, I'm not going to buckle. Like,
right.
I don't, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. It was a tricky time for that department in terms of, I think they ended up getting a little bit of a makeover after that. Actually, as we're talking, one thing I'm realizing is that in terms of occasion, I think I did that ride along before we started to experience this explosion of videos that, you know, since that, I don't know that I would feel comfortable on a ride along today. There's something that I think complicated this essay collection, which is to some degree rooted in my family, my experience of my family, that a lot of the essays are fairly critical of the police and are more kind of situated in this time period of having video after video released and seeing the brutality exerted against Black bodies. And so I think it felt honest, I think, to include an essay that gives space for the narrative of a police officer who's in my family, because I think it's just true that that's part of my experience, and that's part of, and she too, I feel like, as a woman, brought a kind of unique perspective to her role. You know, she's a very nonviolent, well, that's complicated to say, but like, she never used her gun, and she used her personality in a way that I think a lot of people talk about now, and trying to imagine what it would look like to reform police brutality. So I felt like there was something about her voice in particular that feels important to think about now, because she's just a very clever, competent communicator. And it was really fascinating to see her on the job, diffusing tension and knowing how to read a situation, because I think so much of the problem is that people don't bring that skill set. And, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but so I think that's part of why it felt necessary to bring that essay into the collection, even though there's a lot about it that I'm unsettled by. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you mention gender as well, as your cousin is as a woman, because I think in the ride along day that you're narrating or writing about, that there's, it's all women cops that are on a scene, mm-hmm. and you even are aware that maybe that's what made this domestic scene play out the way it did. If other people had been involved, perhaps it wouldn't have.
There was
it
a
would
lot
have
of,
escalated.
Yeah.
Or...
There was a lot of just listening and concern. That was one of the things that was truly remarkable, is how much the three women who responded to this call wanted to make sure she was going to be okay. Like, I was really taken aback by their level of concern. I think there's a lot to say, I guess, about what I think women can bring to a situation like that, and to a lot of the kinds of situations that they were encountering, because in so many ways, women aren't safe, even if they are in an empowered position. And I think that fact was really salient for me in that moment.
And it seems like to have, as part of a police force, more people represented across all different demographics and personal histories, so that more can be like understood somehow. And because it's a job I wouldn't want to do, but
yeah,
we, I don't know, but think, I guess we, anyway,
there's a lot to be said about revisioning
yes,
our systems. Yeah.
And how people, behave with authority.
That's for sure.
Well, yeah. Okay, let's take a break.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Isha Sabatini Sloan is here, dreaming of Ramadi in Detroit. I'm T. Hetzel, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Isha Sabatini Sloan is here, Dreaming of Robati in Detroit, the book on the table with us. Thank goodness for Prince, right?
Yeah.
Isha, I miss him.
I know. Yeah, me too. Well, then that song, so just because we were in a really heavy place just now,
yes.
I might contextualize where that was coming from. Right after Prince passed away, which was not a happy time, my father and I ended up going on a road trip. And so everywhere we drove, that song was playing. And so that's why I chose it, because I did an essay called, it's very long, Playlist for a Road Trip with Your Father in Honor of His 74th Birthday, which happens to coincide with the occasion of Prince's death and the release of Lemonade, because that was also happening. That was really amazing.
I love that title.
Thank you. I wrote this piece for the online magazine, or like I don't know, the site Autostraddle, and so playlists were like a genre that you could write. But the sort of joke of the essay is that for a playlist, you sort of, you know, write one song and then a little bit about each. And the joke here is that When Doves Cry was really the only song that was playing. And then the other things that sort of intervene are kind of random, like Guns, Germs, and Steel on tape, the audiobook by Jared Diamond. So, yeah, that was, and that piece, while it hits upon some difficult subjects, was a little bit more lighthearted, which was nice to put in a book that's fairly grave in a lot of ways. So even though my dad and I were fighting through much of that journey, but it was
what you say,
yeah,
in the essay.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, but you know, that's just almost just how we do. We get along also very well. So, it's just, I think it's funny actually to relay our fights, cause they're so ridiculous. They're so absurd. And it was also a way of surviving that experience to kind of make light of it, or look forward to making light of it, because some of our fights were just so dumb. Yeah.
I feel like there were so many, this time has just flown by, and I'm looking down at my notes and promises made to myself that we would get to. So we're just going to have to talk again, I hope, at some point.
Love to.
Love that too. Let's go to the very beginning of the book again. Sure. The epigraphs that you chose. One by William Pope L. and one by Galway Kinnell.
Do you want me to read them?
That would be great.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back to the selection of these. Black people are the window and the breaking of the window. And that's from a William Pope L. painting, which I actually just saw. I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking about Lorna Simpson, who has an exhibit up in New York right now. And in one of the books of her work, more recent work, Elizabeth Alexander quotes the exact same quote. And she came to visit this year, and it was one of the most beautiful visits. So I was really taken by the fact that she was quoting him too. There's something about that quote, even though I kind of can't quite get to the end of it, it keeps you spinning. Black people are the window and the breaking of the window. Something kind of explosive and like an epiphany, but also this allusion to broken glass, which is a complicated kind of, that sort of loops you back around to the window. So there's
that. It feels so vital and alive.
Yeah.
And positive in the way, not in a Pollyanna type of way, but in the, like, the some necessary, like it's like right.
Like a glass ceiling situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, glass.
Yeah. Well, and he, you know, he's a performance artist whose work I absolutely, I don't know if adore is the right word for it, because the things that come to mind are quite intense and crude, and I think he's really trying to bring us into these spaces. Like, I was just rethinking about one of his pieces where he just crawled along the hot pavement in New York City as a performance, but also to sort of, and I think this is quoting from an interview, but draw attention to the lived experience of homeless people, mm-hmm. which is making his work seem in some ways more linear than it is. But there's also this wonderful Eileen Miles essay where she talks What I Saw, which I bring it up all the time because it's just such a beautiful description of a piece that she saw him perform at a writing residency or an artist residency. And I make reference to it in the last essay, Caldera, which if I can find, I might just say a quote from it. It was just, in the essay, Miles describes the time she watched William Popel perform A Negro Sleeps Beneath the Susquehanna at an artist's residency. He keeps uttering the word crab. He keeps saying, wish I could dream. He straps a mirror to his back with jagged lines of tape struck across it, wades down a river, and disappears. And so there's more to it, but there's just something about his work that feels essential right now. I feel like he's doing something really important. And then the Galway Canal quote, not the songs of light said to wave through the bright hair of angels, but a blacker rasping flowering on that tongue. One of the essays, we just almost accidentally ended up when I was teaching at the New England Literature Program, which was a really magical trip. We went to the Bread and Puppet Theater in Vermont, and they just so happened to know Galway Canal, and he was still alive. And we had this extraordinary visit, and it was something that we all felt so, so strongly about. And so I tried to write an essay about that experience, but there's something about his work and that encounter, because he had Alzheimer's at the time, and it was a very sad encounter on some level. But I guess it sort of loops back to that experience of thinking about the importance of understanding and appreciating the fact of our mortality, and how there's a kind of wisdom that feels, I guess, like a blacker rasping flowering on that tongue, sort of more rooted in the sort of wisdom and difficulty of mortality than sort of brightness. I don't know, that it just felt like it was in conversation with something that I was trying to work through in the book or chew on. Yeah.
Like you were just also saying and gesturing, like important, like it seems like somehow it's like another piece, like you were talking about earlier, Isha. It wouldn't have been right just to have one, because you need something else to refract or to bounce from.
Yeah.
And these other voices.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, yeah, I struggled with that. I had it just as the William Popel for a long time, and I felt like it needed something else.
And then I wonder, maybe for the next book, there'll be even another one. Because I was thinking, well, we could, Wendy S. Walters.
Oh, yes, I love her. In. Yeah.
It's so important that your voice is on the page, Isha.
And thank you.
Thanks for having, I don't know, talking today and having your voice here over the radio waves too.
Thank you for asking me really important questions. I appreciate it.
You're too kind. Come back anytime.
Okay.
we should do a shout out to Hannah.
Yeah.
Shout out to Hannah and to...
Hey, Hannah.
Friends, family listening.
I didn't tell my parents, but maybe they'll listen to it later.
On the website.
Hey, Mom and Dad. Hey, Aunt Catherine. Hey, everybody, I love you.
Many thanks to Isha Sabatini-Sloan for being on today's program. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Live from Ann Arbor, this is the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, and I'm joined by Joey, Bowen, and Jet. Bowen joining us on a DSR for the very first time, so welcome to the show, Bowen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
As you know, welcome. It's April. It's the second week of April, and that means it's time for mock drafts. And I took the liberty of coming in prepared with a mock draft of my own. So for today's show, we're just going to run through my mock draft, and you guys are going to get to break it down, discuss it. Let's have a good one. All right, so we're not going to be going in order of each and every single pick, but it's more we're going to be like, I'll drop like 5 picks at a time, and then you guys get to discuss them, because one, we don't have an entire like 2 days to do a full-on mock draft, and two, like, since so many of the picks affect each other, it's better we discuss them in groups. All right, so we're just going to start off with the top 5, which I think a lot of people know how it's going to go, but I'll just go anyway. So at number 1, I have Caleb Williams to the Bears. At number 2, I have Jaden Daniels to the Washington Commanders. At number 3, I have Drake May to the New England Patriots. At number 4, I think the Cardinals are going to stay put with Marvin Harrison Jr. But at number 5, I think this is where we get our first big trade. This is going to be the one that shapes the draft. I think the Vikings are going to move up to number 5 to take J.J. McCarthy. So, just maybe let's just go around. Don't just say, like, what do you think on that group movement of picks? Because that's pretty much, like, the quarterbacks at the very top of the draft. So just think, like, do you think that's likely? Do you like those moves? Go for it.
Yeah, that sounds like pretty standard QB. I think it's going to go that way for the top. Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, top 3. I do like the Cardinals staying put. I have heard rumors that they would want up to 3 first-round picks to move down, which is